Welcome to another episode of Roaming with Restless Women. Today, I have my first guest from across the pond, and I'm so excited. Elizabeth Salaru. Elizabeth started her first multi-award-winning business with a secondhand mixer and 40 pounds in the bank. That would be dollars, people. Over the years, through creativity and sheer hard work, she built it into a world-renowned business called Elizabeth's Cake Emporium. With this experience, she wrote a book called Opulencia. I hope I said that right. Artisan
Yeah.
Baking and Sugarcraft, which is a bestseller. Now she owns another business and she helps small businesses in the luxury sector figure out how to find their dream clients. As someone who has successfully built a real luxury business brand through sheer hard work and creativity, she's not just another coach or a consultant. She's the real deal. She's been there, done that. She served ultra high net worth individuals and royal families in a world of discretion, confidentiality, and non-disclosure agreements, all while she collaborated with many luxury brands, including Harrods, Oscar de la Renta, and Fendi. She's also been called a pioneer in the industry, and her work has appeared in Vogue, Tatler, Hello, Martha Stewart, Wedlux, and The Telegraph. She's also had personal appearances on the BBC, which I'm so jealous of, by the way. Sky Living's Who'd Be a Billionaire, and she has consulted on films like Sony Columbia's My Best Friend's Wedding. I saw that. Oh my gosh. I'm with a celebrity. Finally, she has two acclaimed podcasts, one called Luxury Business Podcast and the other Luxury News Weekly. Welcome, 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 Elizabeth. You're my first guest, like I said, from across the pond.
Thank you, Julie. I'm so excited to be here. And I love that I'm the first.
Yay. It's great. Now, of course, when I read your story, I thought, I've got a mixer. But I sure don't have a dream to be the best baker. So tell me about how you started your first business and the lessons that you learned that then have bloomed into your current business.
Thank you so much. So I'm going to start brief potted history. I was a scientist. I changed careers. I became a headhunter in the city. And then 2008, everybody got laid off. So I lost my job. And I'd reached a milestone birthday, and I thought to myself, if I don't do it now, I'll never do it. So I decided to set up a childhood dream, which was owning a cake business. And as I said, there was no money, secondhand mixer, and I quickly realized that I needed clients. So I fell back on the one thing that I'd been trained to do when I was a headhunter, and that was cold calling. But in addition to cold calling, I was doing something else. After managing, initially you get family and friends order from you, then that circle widens. So I remember one day I was chatting with the delivery driver, and he said that because in the UK we have, in those days we had, before Uber, we had what we call minicab firms. So they're not official taxis, but they're like minicabs. So I, you know, and I used him regularly. And he said to me, oh, you do know that we leaflet. And because I saw the leaflets in his car, and I'm like, what do you mean leaflet? He said, we literally distribute leaflets to different neighborhoods all across London. And I said, do you happen to go to posh neighborhoods, you know, really rich ones? He said, yes. I'm like, if I give you cards, would you be able to leaflet for me? And he said, yes, of course. So I went to his office, I asked permission, and for the sum of about 10 or 20 pounds every week, they did leafletting for me. And I knew they did because every time they leafleted, I would get at least three different clients, proper clients. So that was one thing. The second thing was the cold calling. So I took the yellow pages one day, and I started calling every event planner and every wedding planner in the yellow pages. I made well over 100 calls, I remember, because I was exhausted after about 3 days, telling my story, trying to And then one particular afternoon, I think it was a Wednesday, a young girl, I remember she said, "Do you make cupcakes?" Now remember, early 2000s, mid 2000s, cupcakes were like the best thing since sliced bread.
Oh, yes.
And I said, "Of course we make cupcakes." And I said to her, "By the way, I'm going to be in your area in the next 3 days. Would you like me to bring some samples?" And she said, "Yes, that'd be amazing." So I took some samples. After 3 days, I bought the best boxes I could find, took the cupcakes along, and I remember just literally dropping them and running out because I just said, "Oh, delivery from Elizabeth." And while I was on the bus on the way back home, I got a phone call saying, "Lady Elizabeth would like to see you." And I'm like, in my head, I was like, "Who's Lady Elizabeth?" It turned out this was Lady Elizabeth Anson, cousin to the late Queen Elizabeth. So
Oh.
I went back to the office and she said, "Your cupcakes were superb, tasted them, loved them. I want to place an order right away for 200 or thereabouts." And she gave me a check, which was my first ever check from a private bank. So I was so excited, but unfortunately, I was too poor not to cash it. So, and then from then on, she'd use me for events, etc. But the best thing she did for me, and this was unasked, and she didn't have to do it, and I'm eternally grateful. She then wrote me a handwritten note saying, "Your cakes were the best of the night. We had three cake makers. Yours tasted the best. They were amazing. And you can use my words in all your marketing material." So, of course, I did. I splashed her words
Oh.
everywhere. And I thought to myself, this is the nicest thing that anyone has ever done. This is like incredible. So, that was how I kind of started my business and I started getting into the luxury side of things.
That's amazing. So just that one idea, that one contact, and then it just blooms.
Yeah,
That's
absolutely. And then
great.
remember, I was also doing the leafletting. So
Yes.
I was, again, I mean, we're talking houses where they had gated communities, had private roads. They had their own private police, which is a bit rare in the UK, by the way. I know in America you've got, but in the UK, so that's a bit rarer. So I was getting into those houses as well. And then I was getting into really, really high-end hotels as well. So I deliver a cake. I remember once I did a wedding, I deliver the cake, and the director of events, he what because it was at that time it was the most high-end wedding they've ever done. It was actually through leafleting. That was how I got that client. So I delivered the cake and he said, "You are going on our suppliers list." He said, "Your cakes are incredible." I mean, he said, "This is incredible. This is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. You are going up." So again, being on the supplier list of that particular hotel, which is arguably the best in London, is things like that that came together to open up the high net worth world for me.
And so how so then you've kind of moved away from the banking, am I correct? Or is that still your company?
It's still my go-to, but for certain clients. So if they
Yeah.
want to fly me out or if they want to have me deliver the cakes to their country, I still take orders like that. But for the
Okay.
most part, it's my consultancy that I'm focused on.
Well, so okay, so let's talk about your consultancy. What is your main value that you bring with your consultancy? And tell me the name of it too, because I don't think I mentioned that earlier.
Okay. I just called it the Luxury Business Emporium
Love it.
to mirror the cake emporium. And I love that question because the value I bring, I've actually summarized in my book, The Luxpreneur. Because when I look at helping people or coaching people in the luxury sector or people who want to get into the luxury sector, I look at it in three distinct ways. So the first is you've got to have a luxury mindset. And I don't mean spend oodles of money on designer stuff. That is not luxury. I mean you yourself as an individual, you need to look at yourself in terms of what your why, who are you? And to give an example, I did archetypes of the different luxury brand owners that I've ever come across, and I got about nine different archetypes. So for example, when I typed myself, I'm an artisan and visionary. That is good and bad. That is good because obviously I will focus on craftsmanship. That is why a lot of people love my cakes. And then visionary, because I'm always thinking of the future, I'm always thinking ahead. And that's great. You know, when you have the vision, you can see things that other people don't see. But here's the problem. Because I'm such a craftsman, I will spend all the money creating the best product and not think of margins, not think of promotion, not think of strategy and stuff that I find tedious. I hate admin. So again, that's a downside of being an artist. And then being a visionary, I need to be grounded in the present because I'm always thinking ahead, but I need someone operational to say, okay, let's think about how we're paying the bill today, not the 10, not the 10 fantastic ideas of what this could be tomorrow. So that's part one about you, luxury mindset. Who are you? Because every luxury client you meet, they want to know your why. They want to know, are you trying to just weasel them out of money or are you authentic? So they want to know. So that's why you need to know who you are. Then there's a second part. In my view, there are five things, five pillars of a luxury business. So imagine a table with four legs, and then there's a central pillar running through. So in addition to things like your business model, your marketing, your customer service, and your product, the fifth one, which I feel is absolutely essential, is the storytelling. So what story are you telling around your product? So I use the example of a peanut butter jar. The same peanut butter could be in a, I don't know, Costco, five for $10. And you can take the same peanut butter jar and place it in a high-end store. But the stories will be different. If I don't get my favorite brand in Costco, that's not going to upset me. But if I take the same jar and I put it in a high-end environment, and I tell the story of how the peanuts are only harvested at 4 in the morning. They're harvested by hand. They're shelled in a particular way to preserve all the nutrients. The ground, the peanuts are ground in a particular way so that the peanut butter comes out smooth. The jar is handmade and it's only 10 of it in the world. Once I start building that story, it's amazing how suggestive storytelling is. It means that people start imagining, and before you know it, that jar of peanut butter becomes immensely valuable. And then, if I want to up it again, I can say, and by the way, I'm only producing 20 this year, and there's a waiting list. And that is a power of storytelling when it comes to luxury. And in my book, I actually break down how you can tell your same story and the other five pillars I discuss at length and how you can create the same thing. And then the final part of what I do is luxury clients. Again, I've created eight archetypes of luxury client. Underlying everything is, of course, trust, but different luxury clients buy things differently. So let me give you a really funny example. King Charles. Okay, King Charles, our king. And Ozzy Osbourne. Right. Okay. And people go, huh. And I'm like, okay. They were born in the same year. They're both white male. They are maybe 1 month apart. They've both been divorced twice, and they both live in a castle. According to demographics, you will sell to them the same, right? But according to psychographics and other factors that I elaborate in my book, you will not sell to them the same. because they're different archetypes and they're motivated by different things. Now, as human beings, we don't neatly fit into a box. You know, we can't say, oh, you know, you're this archetype and that's it, because, you know, we're a bit more fluid than that. But at least it gives you a guide and it gives you an idea of how different clients in different archetypes, how they think and what motivates them to buy. So that, in a nutshell, is how I add value.
That's beautiful. I love that. So, because it seems to me like you get beyond the data on a page. So,
Yes.
you know, your typical marketing research would have you believe that these are the exact client kind of clients that you should be going after. But I think when you add, what is the value that I'm bringing, and how would they see, what is their perception of that value? Then that makes a huge difference in how you approach. So that's incredible that you've got those archetypes. That's amazing. And what is your new book? I mean, I mentioned Opulencia, but what's your new book?
The new book is called The Luxpreneur.
Okay.
Just wanted to keep it, you know, simple, made up word. It's called The Luxpreneur. And I love what you said, and you've got it, about going beyond the data. Because in luxury, it's not just the data. It's not just, oh, we have X amount of footfall, or this is the age, location, and blah, 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 blah. No, motivations are a lot more complex. But when you break things down, you can actually make things simpler to understand, because you need to go beneath the data. Data just tells you, it's a snapshot of that particular moment. However, there are other underlying things. You know, how did they get to you? How did they find you? Are they staying? Are they leaving? Are they going to buy from you once? Are they going to be lifetime clients? There's a particular archetype, they stay with you for generations, literally. And there's another archetype where they want to experiment. They would, in fact, want to co-create with you. They would actually
Yes.
want to, yeah, they want to co-create with you. So if you understand that, even, and also because I was dealing with weddings where you have very heightened emotions, where you have very personal vibes. And I say this, everybody, no matter how rich, they love free cake. There's something about cake and drink and people loosen up. So you get to know people on an intimate level, and that allows you to understand a bit of psychology of why they do what they do and why, and the kind of even cultural influences that get them to buy.
Give me one example of the cult of a cultural influence in your world.
Okay. So I'll give an example of an amazing couple. They are from different parts of the world. Once, I think China, or is it Singapore? And one of them's from elsewhere. I don't want to give too much away, but you know, you've got the Chinese, you're there. And then they met in Paris, but they decided to get married in London. Right. And obviously very ultra high net worth, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously they wanted to bring in the culture from their home countries, as well as British culture, as well as French culture.
Oh my goodness.
Exactly.
That's a
So
tall order.
that's a tall order, but it's doable. It's not impossible at all. So it's about understanding, okay, this is what they say they want. And then when you begin to flesh it out, you then realize that you it, again, when you speak to your clients, you can kind of, like, you're there as the expert, and you need to be seen as the expert. So you can say, I can give you, and that's another thing you need to do. You need to curate for them. So some people, the mistake I see many of my coaching clients do is give like 25 options, too many options.
Oh,
You need
yeah.
to curate and give two or three options and say, these are optionals, and defend your options. And they might say, we hate, you know, and again, even them hating all of it, that's a great sign, because, you know, okay, I hate that, let's stop. So with that couple, for example, there were certain things we incorporated into the wedding. We said, okay, this will serve you here, this will serve you there, this will serve you there. So, for example, I remember when I was setting up the dessert table, I had things in groups of eight because the double eight is a lucky number for weddings in particular. They had at this at the wedding, they had somebody called a lucky lady. So a lucky lady is someone who is respectable, married, has children, has been in a long-term marriage, and able to give wise counsel to the couple. So she's in essence standing as a sort of not a guarantor, but standing there as someone to help protect the marriage. And
Nice.
the funny thing is, in that somebody like that actually exists in other cultures. Sometimes you call them matchmakers, sometimes you call them, the old wise woman that everyone has got to say hello to, or it could even be the grandma in the family. So again, it's knowing these cultures and knowing these nuances and intricacies and the importance it has to the couple or the family, and then just going along accordingly. So somebody like the lucky lady, for example, she could be a key decision maker. If you did not, you would think the couples, they're the decision makers, but it could be that lady, it could be the parents, or it could be somebody else entirely. So those are some of the cultural nuances.
Wow. So what is the biggest transition or obstacle that you've had to go through in your career so far?
I think the biggest obstacle for me was mindset from scientist to headhunter, because I'd worked in a lab all my life. I'd never worked in an office. And I had this scientific CV, and I didn't know how to tailor it for a job in the city. So what I then decided was, okay, I will network. So via networking, and I found a couple of job hunting workshops. I learned, and it absolutely happened that in about, I think in about 2, 3 years, I started running those workshops for that company, oddly enough. So it was, that was the hardest shift, shifting my mindset from, okay, in a lab, this is these are the standard operating procedures, there's consistency, there's da 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 da. So that was a massive, massive shift. That was an obstacle. And to help me overcome that obstacle, I hired a coach. I had a career coach, I remember. And I remember, and looking back now, I thought I was paying her a fortune, but looking back now, I was thinking, oh my God, that was peanuts. And she was a no nonsense, wouldn't let me wallow kind of person. And she would challenge, she would say, okay, and I'm like, oh, I can't, oh, I wouldn't. And she was like, no, let's go over it. This is what, So that really, really helped me. So to overcome that obstacle. And of course, in that environment, I was thinking, am I good enough? Am I, these are people that they went to the right schools, they've got the right connections to bring in jobs. What do I have? But then I realized, actually, I had a couple of things. So I started writing for the company website, which gave me visibility. So the articles were put on the homepage. So my name was up there with a big boss's name. I wrote these articles. I also started talking. So I gave lots of job hunting workshops. I represented the company. So they'll put me in front of 3,000 chief execs. It wasn't an issue for me at all, to just, because I felt I was just chatting with 200 friends or whatever it was. And then I did some business schools as well to raise my profile. I did a couple of other things. I joined the Association of MBAs. I helped talk. So it was a period of learning, but at the same time, developing myself. I really, really was very keen to the, and in developing myself, it helped me overcome some of the obstacles.
Absolutely. And that, from there to creating your own company, it sounds like you got a lot from that experience, just from going from scientist to headhunter. And why did you want to do that anyway?
You mean headhunting?
Yeah.
I kind of fell into it because what happened was, in order to help me transition from scientist to business, because I just got it in my head, oh, I'd like to do something with business. I did an MBA because obviously, business administration, I'll do an MBA. And while I was doing the MBA, I just had this realization that, oh my God, no one's going to hire me because a lot of the jobs in the city, they wouldn't know what to do with my scientific background.
Oh, I
So
see.
I then thought to myself, how about, again, I think my thinking then wasn't exactly right because I could have if I'd known how, but I didn't know how. So I then badgered my business school, and then the business school said to me, okay, why don't you set up a tiny department? I'm talking about maybe half an office, no money, an email.
Yeah.
Set up a little office, and then you can help other MBA students. So what I decided to do was use that job to reach out to a lot of recruiters, a lot of headhunters, and I did a lot of networking. So while I was doing that was when I was spotted by a headhunter, and then when he left the firm he was working at and wanted to start his own firm, he tapped me on the shoulder and said, would you like to work for me? And of course I said yes. So it was
Yeah.
so that was my bridging job into, oh my God, finally I am working in an office of sort, but I just happened to really like it, and I happened to really love headhunting because it was a matchmaking service. I had to sell the candidate to the client and the client to the candidate, and also manage expectations because the client, they thought they were better than what they were. And some candidates also think the same. So it's about managing expectations on both sides. It's like saying to a guy who says, I don't know who's the hottest supermodel right now. I want maybe a Kim Kardashian or Bella Hadid or whatever. And I have to say, sweetheart, you're not that rich, you're not tall. Let's,
Yeah.
manage. I know you're looking for a 10, So I had to do that a lot. So I just realized it was just matchmaking. And it's also about psychology and reading people, because if you have a chief exec in front of you telling you how amazing he is, you have to read beneath, go deeper, and is he just, talking himself up? Because some people present amazing CVs and then they're talking and you're thinking, there's a bit of a mismatch.
Right.
And then you have people who do not so great CVs, but they're great interviews. So you're thinking, So yeah, so you had to do a lot of almost detective work, as it were.
Well, okay. So I usually close with three questions.
Okay.
Have you listened to my podcast? Do you know what
Yes, I know what
that is? Okay. Act like you don't know. All
they are.
right.
Okay.
So, if you would close your eyes,
Yes.
and when I say wise woman, I'd like
Yes.
for you to open your eyes and then describe the picture that appeared in your brain.
Okay.
Wise woman.
Dolly Parton.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely.
Dolly
Absolutely.
Parton. Dolly Parton, all the way.
And why is that?
Oh my God, where do I start? That woman has written over 3,000 songs. She has sold. She is an astute businesswoman. She's the
Yes.
only person to have said no to Elvis Presley, which thank God she did, or else would never have I Will Always Love You.
Yes.
That she sang in a movie, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, blah, blah, blah. But for me, it's her altruism, it's her charity work, it's how she is, how she developed her hometown. She pays every high school student money. She sends books to people, to kids all over America, millions of books, by the way. She has done
Yes.
more for, she's done more for literacy than probably any other person on this planet. Very humble with it, doesn't brag about it. Very down to earth on Twitter, where I follow her religiously. The woman, and then she's come out with the most amazing sayings ever. And she doesn't, you know, even if you make fun of her appearance or whatever, she is so resilient. So I think if the world had more dollies, we will not be in the mess that we are in right now.
Amazing, 100%, 1,000,000% agree with you on that. We actually we travel in our RV. That's what the roaming is all about. And we were in Sevierville in Gatlinburg, the area where Dollywood is and everything. And she, a little known fact about her is that she will not wear makeup, not do her hair, and go out and camp in the camp in campgrounds with her husband. Nobody knows who she is. Yeah, that's, but he is so intensely private. He wants nothing to do with, all of it. And just the thought of her being so authentic in every part of her life, he really is. And that, to me, that's the ultimate goal of anyone's life, is to bring everything that you have in a humble way and add value to the lives of others and create value for the world. So,
Absolutely.
100% agree with you on that. Okay. Where do you like to roam?
Italy.
Oh, lovely. Tell
I
me,
love
where's your favorite place there?
my favorite place ever is a place called Il Boro. It's like an estate, like a massive estate. And it's privately owned by a family. And it's so ideal. It's the most tranquil place that I've ever been. It's just so tranquil. It's like a
Oh.
village. They've got a Michelin-starred chef restaurant on site. They've got horse riding, wine making, lemons, olive oil. It's like a little town village, and it's just you get proper rest. You get proper just shut off from the world kind of rest. So that's why I love it.
How important is rest? I'm telling you, sometimes I feel like, how long has it been since I actually rested? Really? I'm all about that too. So, what makes you restless in a good way?
Oh, I think for me, what makes me restless is I just want to share. I love sharing with the world. For me, it would be something around leaving a legacy. I want to know that my coming into this world is not for nothing. I didn't just come for me. I feel I'm obligated to serve my community. I'm obligated to make this world a tiny bit better than how I found it. So that for me is very, very important, because it's easy to say, oh, people are not nice, so we can, but what are you
Right.
doing? What is it you yourself are doing to make the world a better place? So that's very
Yep.
important to me. So that's what makes me restless. The because I've got a niece, I've got a couple two nephews, and I want them to know that I left a legacy, I left something, and I didn't just come, you know. Yes, there's nothing wrong with coming and living your life and blah blah blah, but at least I want them to be able to point to something that I
Yeah.
did. So that is what makes me restless.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for being on the podcast. You have been an amazing guest. And ladies and gentlemen, when you listen to this podcast or watch it on YouTube, you will get so much out of it. And I hope you have. Everything that you need to know about Elizabeth, how to get a hold of her, and the information about her books will be in the show notes. So thank you for watching and or listening. And we'll talk to you next time, Elizabeth. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Julie. This has been a lovely conversation. And thank you for sharing another nugget about Dolly Parton. I
Yeah.
truly.
Oh, well, thank you. And we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Okay, thank you, Julie. Thank you so much.